So we're now in Luke 19, and I'll read the first 10 verses. It's about Zacchaeus, and I think most of you know, heard the name Zacchaeus, right? For those who don't, he was a wee little man, and a wee little man was he. And I did that at first service, and Amy had to hold the chair to not start singing that song. Like, she was that close. I probably shouldn't have done it there. It was stumbling for her. But then Jesus entered and passed through Jericho. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus who was a chief tax collector, and he was rich, and he sought to see who Jesus was. But he could not because of the crowd, for he was of short stature. So he ran ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see, for he was going to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said to him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must stay at your house. So he made haste and came down and received him joyfully. But when they saw it, they all complained. Large crowd, doesn't say just the Pharisees, doesn't even say not the disciples. It says, when they saw it, they all complained. You can deduce from that whatever you want. But it's like in mass, he's gone to be a guest with a man who's a sinner. Then Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, look, Lord, I give half my goods to the poor, and if any I've taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because he is also a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost. Gail told me that I don't dare start this without telling you about the bishop that taught in Africa in a huge seminar that we were in, a huge conference we were in, and a guy that had been around for a very long time ministering from the early days of the revivals in Malawi. And he said, he did the story of Zacchaeus. He goes, now Zacchaeus was 3 feet tall. He was kind of real clear about that. And then he said, and you know, he had to fight the kids to get up in the tree, because you know, the kids are always in the trees when there's events like that. So I don't know if we kind of went, well, maybe he was there, but you know, but what we do know is that what we do know about Zacchaeus, first of all, I never looked up his name before, and I've gone over Zacchaeus a lot of times. His name means pure. And he's a relative from the Ezra Nehemiah return, where we have the name in a shorter form, but it's the same name, is Zach, is in Ezra Nehemiah, from the people that returned from the captivity that came back into Jerusalem, and only a small percentage of the Israelites came back. And his relatives were among them. It doesn't tell us which tribe. What we also know about him, he's very rich. He's not short on money. But in life, he really, in another way, he came up really short in life. If you were going to make a movie about this guy, you'd probably cast Zacchaeus, but use Danny DeVito. And I have nothing against him, but I'm actually sorry that I know that name, but I do. Danny, chief tax collector, chief among publicans in another place, those who labored with the Roman government to extort and take from the people, and that's why they were hated by the entire nation of Jewish religious people, and even just anybody in Israel. They took tolls, they took rent money for renting farms and using, and they charged exorbitant rates, and they did extortion on people. That's how they made. Instead of making $20 off of this situation, if they could find a way to make $40 off of it, they had no problem doing that, by squeezing you and demanding of you and finding manipulative ways to control you. And, you know, who knows how he got here? We don't. We don't know if he just was raised by a publican, a tax collector family. We don't know if it really, being a small guy in a place, you know, we in our culture right now, there's a great attempt made to stop bullying. It's not completely working, but it is. There's a huge attempt made. Throughout history, you know, if you were small, if you had some other problem, that's not a problem. But if you were small, it's not a problem. It's. I was just reaching to the next thought, and I am old. If you have some kind of problem, in you is just very common to be picked on. This is human nature. This is sinful, fallen human nature. You don't fix it by just education. You fix it by regeneration, by a change of heart. You can't educate people completely out of being mean. You can't do it. You can't educate people completely out of drug use. And you know, we all, our addictions and needs, all of us, needs the hand of God on us. And our cultures need the hand of God on them. So who knows what he went through as a kid and the way that he could get through it. I don't know that. But I don't, did he have to fight with bigger kids all the time? Did he say, well, money's the way I can get big. But you know what? Unlike the rich young ruler who we read about 2 weeks ago, who I believe there's like a flow between the rich young ruler, blind Bartimaeus, who we read last week, and now Zacchaeus. It's all what happened, but it's also God's maybe insight that unlike the rich young ruler, you know, people didn't make way for Zacchaeus because he was rich, because they hated him. They would, and probably, you know, when you're in a line and so you can feel somebody on your shoulder trying to cut in, you kind of do this, you Christian, you. Why don't you step back and say, go ahead, all of you. So, you know, nobody made room for Zacchaeus. Nobody was looking to let him in. He had to, I don't think he had to fight kids for a spot in the tree, but he wasn't afraid to go up there, and he was not respected, unlike the rich young ruler. But much like blind Bartimaeus, who was after the rich young ruler, he was persistent. I'm going to see Jesus, and I don't care if people think I'm out of my tree. I'm going to go up there and see Jesus. A moan would have been better than silence. Jesus looks up and sees him. It seems when Jesus came to town, to me, that when Jesus came to a town, to a synagogue, to a home, anywhere, those people whose hearts within them had hearts to hear from him, those people who had a heart to grab a hold of him, those people who had a heart to be touched by Jesus found him. And wherever he went, he also found those people. Have you noticed that about Jesus? Like, there's times where I grieve because I don't see somebody being reached out to that seems to be alone or in need many places. And I'm not always able to, or in the presence of mind or whatever, or obedient, or just not capable of meeting all those needs. You know, nobody is. None of us are. And you think, oh, they're so alone, and they're not, they have such a need, or they're in some situation. And, you know, it's really good to remember, certainly not as an excuse to be cavalier and not care and engage, but to remember there's one person that they never escape his sight. They never escape his care. And that's you too. See, we elevate the lowly like Jesus did in our Christian language and our Christian thought processes. We lift up those who are needy and don't just go for, well, who's rich and famous that we can have be a part of our thing. And, you know, we do it because it's the heart of Jesus, and I'll tell you, we should do it. And I'll tell you what else. It makes you think about how Jesus is with you. And, you know, I'll tell you this. People who are very judgmental and always looking down at other people and only looking for people that fit into their category, that's how they look at God, that he's like them, you know? And so they have probably a very shallow, touched relationship with the Lord, because it's all based on their own view of how people should be this way, and if they're not this way, then just kick them out of here. And if you're like that, it's probably your view of how God looks at you, and you're probably really not happy in your relationship with the Lord. You're not going, oh, I'm really close to God, and I'm really good, but that guy, no. I don't think, I know there's that hypocrisy, but I think most people live under what they believe about other people. You live under it. And it's a trap. It's why I'm kind of like strong about saying, I joke around and stuff, I'm sure far too much, but as far as being purposely caustic and harsh and mean-spirited and fighting battles with toe-to-toe with people, I don't see that as fruitful. I see making a stand. You make a stand when you have to, but you don't do it with an angry heart. And people with angry hearts probably think God's got an angry heart all the time too. Just how it works. And you don't have to agree with me, but that's what I've seen. So Zacchaeus is really touched by the Lord, and Jesus says, I got to come to your house to stay. Remember when he sent out his disciples and the 70? He said, whenever you find a house, in Mark he says, whoever is worthy there, go into that house and stay there. And what would make the person worthy is they were somebody who would actually welcome them and say, hey, you can stay at my house. And even if they were poor, but they had a great heart to welcome you, took it. And here's this guy Zacchaeus. Jesus isn't going to his house because he's got good food and he's rich. Jesus is going to his house because he's making this man worthy. And because he wants everyone there to know what salvation looks like and what redemption looks like and what the identity that a person can have in Jesus Christ looks like. And so Jesus doesn't command him to do what he says, but he says, I'm gonna give half my goods to the poor. And if I've taken anything from anyone falsely, which would be extortion, or lying and cheating, which would happen a lot with a really rich top chief tax collector, that's how he got there. So we're talking about a serious dent in his fortune. Because if it would have been, I'm just going to give back what I took, that was unfair, I guess he'd be okay. Half his goods to the poor. That's pretty profound. Has anybody here taken your bank account and split it in half and just given half of it away? Didn't think so. I don't. There maybe you're just being humble and not telling us you've given it all away, but that's a pretty serious commitment. And Jesus didn't command or ask him, but he does proclaim this salvation. Now, Zacchaeus' offer, where does he get the idea to do this? I can't say for sure, but I can tell you if he looked into the scriptures that were his Old Testament that he would call just the Bible, he would look into Exodus 22. Because in Exodus 22, you find that the law of God said that if a man stole from his neighbor, let's say it was a sheep or whatever, goat or something, and he took it and killed it to eat it, or he sold it and it's gone, they catch you, you have to restore five times. He said if you steal something, an animal like this or something, and they find you with it, they take it back, and then you still have to give them another one. You have to double what you took. There were no prisons in ancient Israel. If you committed a capital crime, you were executed. If they did it right, they would execute you. If you didn't commit a capital crime, but you did all these other things, you would be held to account to make it right and better than how you started it. And if you couldn't just do that, you would be, when we say sold as a slave, it was a 6-year service to the person you stole from. And you would serve them for 6 years, and then you would be free. There was no carrying of continuous debt if they did it right. There was no prisons if they did it right. You know, think about that. Interesting. And you see, the whole issue there is if you've wronged others, make it good. It goes on in Exodus 22 and says basically about a bunch of different things with different amounts. It says, when you've done something wrong and hurt your brother or sister, go back and make it right and make it better than it started. So I have on the front of your bulletin the words of Jesus. It's not an exact match, but it's very interesting. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, a gift to God, and there you remember that your brother has something against you, and this can be brother, sister, brethren, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way, and first be reconciled to your brother, and then come offer your gift. You know, here's what it doesn't say. Go home and make a list of everyone you've ever wronged in your life and go try to fix it. You have a great time doing that. It'll never work. You'll be so frustrated and hopeless. And there's things I've done that are wrong that I can't fix because the person's dead, and I never fixed it before they died. Have you got that? Don't raise your hand, but you know what I'm saying. I've got situations where I can't find people, but I later on realized how much I hurt them. Doesn't that hurt you when you think about that? You know what? It isn't the happy, clappy Christian life. I'm a very happy person, but I also deal with sorrow. My own sorrow, my own failures, other people's pain and sorrow. And you got to be okay with that. This isn't about, we're always happy, clappy. This is about soul searching sometimes. And sometimes when I search my soul, I don't like what I've found. But I do love the Lord who I can always come to get realigned. And that's why I'm filled with hope. I'm filled with purpose, and I'm filled with a sense of destiny. And if I spend too much time thinking about me, it's all over. But if I always turn the focus to Him, eventually I get it. And I know when I can fix something or do better. Let's just say do better, and I know when I can't. And this doesn't say that we're supposed to think of everything we've ever done wrong. It says when you bring your gift to the altar, when you're coming before the Lord to seek Him and to honor Him, and He speaks to your heart through your memory. I mean, I've had it so much in my life that it's just, to me, this is just so natural. It's like breathing. I don't mean I've done it perfectly, but it's just I get this. Because this week I wrote to a friend who I was asking to do something that needed to be done, that he had to be a part of, and I threw in when he couldn't do it when I wanted and didn't do it when I wanted, I threw in a little 5-word sentence, I suppose, blah, 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 and I was really saying, it sounded like, if you read it the right, you know how emails, it could sound terrible or great. What I was really saying, and I even kind of knew it in the back of my mind, I still pressed send, was like, I sure wish you'd do it this way. Like a little manipulation, a little, you know, little squeeze, a little, and I knew he couldn't. He already made it clear. And you know what? It haunted me. It came back to me. And it's like, when I was praying and reading the Bible with Gail, we were reading together, we were at the altar. It's like, yeah, remember that, Rick? You just really, you know, he might not even know it, but that's what you did. You were manipulative. You were squeezing. It wasn't godly. It's your friend. And so I went to go call him, but first I went on the internet. I went on my email to for some reason beforehand. I said, I'm going to call him in a few minutes. And there was a note from him, and it said, I had said something like, I don't mean to be a jerk or something like that. He says, Rick, you're this great guy. You're a man of God. You're kind of a joking thing, but a total blessing. Like, I just love you. You're like-minded. And I was like, oh. And I said, he's so busy, I think I'll go ahead and write him back instead of call him. And I did. I said, well, actually, I'm a real jerk because I kind of was manipulative with that sentence. I knew not to do it, and I did. I'm really sorry, brother. And he wrote back and said, no, you're not, you know, gave me more praise. But it's because he loves me. He's my friend. He doesn't care. It was okay. But you know what? I'm so glad that the Lord doesn't let me off the hook. And I can't tell you everything's perfect in Rosie and Ricky land, but I can tell you that I get convicted. And if you don't think that's a big deal and you don't understand that, that's because you don't have a healthy conscience. I'm going to be very bold with you. If you think what I just told you, now you might not understand what I'm saying because I'm trying to be, you know, run through it. But if you think it doesn't matter when you sense that you did something wrong and you have the ability to correct it and you don't correct it and you think that's not a big deal, that's because you don't have a healthy conscience. God wants us to have a clear, clean conscience. You can tell me anything you want. You can reject everything I'm saying. But in the name of Jesus, if you don't care about right and wrong in your heart, you do not have a healthy conscience. And you're destined to go deeper down that road. If you don't stay in never, never land, you go somewhere in your rebellion. You go somewhere in your sin. You go somewhere in lying. You go somewhere. You go deeper. And you don't even notice it. So if your conscience bothers you over small things, thank God. God for it. And if your conscience doesn't bother you ever, pray that God has mercy on you and reveals to you how serious that is. So, I had no idea I was going to do that, but I'll stand by it. So, our goal is to get things better than we started, you know? And that's a really cool thing because that's God's goal. When God kicked Adam and Eve out of the garden for their rebellion and sin, and they were separated from him spiritually, and now he sends them out so they can't just stay there in a separated evil state and live forever that way in a death. And that's a quick thing about it, the way I would explain it, but it's not the whole story. So they're out there. When God restores mankind, does he bring us back to that garden and say, okay, we'll just get you back to Adam? No. That's why in the back of your bulletin, and I won't turn there right now, on the back of your bulletin is a list from Revelation 2 and 3. He that overcomes, the first one is, I will give him to eat of the tree of life that's in the midst of the paradise of God. And it's not talking about the Garden of Eden. That's done. There's going to be a new heavens and a new earth. And there's going to be a new Jerusalem, the city of God, that comes down from heaven. And there's going to be a crystal clear river through it and 12 trees bounding both sides of it. And there's going to be the tree of life. And we're going to eat of life forever, perpetually. And it's kind of a word picture, probably, for a lot of things we'd never understand here about heaven. Heaven's going to be great because if you could explain it fully, it wouldn't be that great. I mean, you can explain Disney World completely to somebody. You can show them pictures of it, and it might be, if they like that stuff, it's great. But you know, you could show them a picture of some, you know, Banff, you know, Alberta, and you can show them your trip there. You can't really show them heaven, can you? The only one that can show you heaven is the Lord in your heart, and you can only get glimpses of it and pictures of it because small pictures, small snippets. And so God reveals to us how to make things better because he's the one that made things better. My destiny with him is better than where Adam started. Hallelujah. That's just to me. So you just ponder that maybe. So now when we get back to Zacchaeus himself, we're not suggesting that every bit of inner turmoil in his life disappeared this day. We're not suggesting that we know all of his inner turmoil. But here's what I see in him. Is that he didn't stand up before Jesus and say, you know, Lord, there's a reason why I took so much money from people. And it's not really my fault. It's the way I was raised. And so he didn't make excuses. He didn't claim to be a victim, but he restores to his victims. Now, let me make this really clear. I am not suggesting that there are no victims. There are plenty of victims, people who have been victimized by others big time. It would be foolish to say there's no victims. I don't think that's the answer to overcoming victimhood. I think overcoming victimhood is acknowledging that it's real, but acknowledging that there is a way and a victory over it. And there, you know, we were all molded by our childhoods. You know, it's why we, some of you, you know, and when I first brought my family, I said, oh, listen, you don't understand. Chopped liver, Jewish chopped liver, chicken liver. It's not like eating liver. It's so good. And my family was finally someplace where there was chopped liver at a Jewish event. And I went up after talking with people, did you try it? Because I said, you got to try the chopped liver. It's, you know, Mrs. Clausen's or whatever. No, and, you know, from my family friend, and Sylvia Katz, that's it, Sylvia Katz. How could I forget Sylvia Katz? And I looked at their plates, and their plates all had chopped liver on it because they said, my kids were like, yeah, Dad. Beth goes, gross. David goes, yucky. Gail goes, Rick, it's still to us, this is just horrible. Why would you eat this? I'm like, really, you don't like it? Well, can I have it? So I took all theirs. And then I realized, you know what? I grew up with my grandma, Grandma Axe. I grew up eating chopped liver, Jewish chopped liver. That's how I grew up. It's in me. There are certain other things that are kind of built into us, aren't they? Not what foods we like, but if you watch us eat at a certain event, you could see what people grew up with. If you go to a buffet, you see the people, you can see it sometimes, what people grew up with, if you see different cultures there. Very interesting. There's something deeper than what you eat. There's what you've received as far as how life works and how your brain works and how your thoughts work. And you know, I believe for all of us, the Lord wants to overcome things that are not right there and that have held us back. And, you know, I will just let Gail speak for herself if you want to ask her in detail. But in 1997, after her life and her troubles that she had, that really formed a lot in her. And I thought she was doing great. But and, I, of course, I love her. She's my wife. But she also came to me and said, right in January, she goes, you know, this is the year. January is a year. I have a name for it. It's the year of no longer being a victim. And how she, like this part, I'll tell you, is that she came to it by saying, by talking with the Lord, and this is her story. And, you know, I'm not telling you yours has to match it. I'm just saying this is her story. As she's, you know, she was thinking about all the things that didn't happen in her life and that happened negatively and the way she was treated that had made life hard for her, you know, hard to just enjoy life as easily as me, for sure. We both know that I didn't have a traumatic childhood. I had, my dad died when I was 15. It was traumatic, but my general upbringing was positive. I was loved. I was encouraged. There were some things that really stuck with me, and there were some things that came to me that I had to deal with. Everybody does. But hers was much more severe. Much more severe. And this was the year of no longer a victim. And she said, I feel like the Lord spoke to my heart and said, you know, so Gail, if you had had all these things, just like your friends, the people you envied in school, the cheerleaders or the girl whose mother put notes in her and gave her her special lunch, this, just that certain way that showed that she loved her, and her dad hugged her all the time and encouraged her, and all the things you... She got along great with her parents later on and all that, but it was a very rough childhood and a very lonely thing. And the Lord said, so if you'd had all those things the way you think they should have been and you wish they were and they would make you happy, would you have needed me? And her answer, this isn't my story, it's her story. You can ask her about it. I'm not lying. She said, no, Lord, I wouldn't have needed you. I mean, in my mind, I would have been, this is what I want, this is what I need, I don't need God. And he wasn't saying when he said to her, this is her words, maybe you should thank those people. He didn't mean go call them and say, hey, thanks for abusing me or being mean to me. He meant in your heart, maybe you should say, God, I thank you that you didn't let me go off on my own without you, and you used even the bad things that happened to bring me to you. And you get to do what you want with that. But letting God declare your identity is where you have to go eventually. For he is a son of Abraham. Salvation has come to his house. This is his identity. And I don't know how you work it all out, but it has to do with having communion, fellowship, koinonia with God. See, the word that we get for communion is a Greek word, koinonia. Many of you have seen, you know, koinonia fellowship, koinonia house, koinonia ministries. If you've seen that, it's because it's the word that we translate into communion, and it means fellowship, which I'm going to explain something about that. Association, communion, joint participation. I have joint participation with God, and I have joint participation with people. I have communion with God and communion with his saints, with others. And this comes to us also with the word oneness you could put in there. So what does it mean to have koinonia or fellowship with God? I was explaining to someone, and I found it difficult when I started to go, what does it mean when I tell you, do you have fellowship with God? Do you feel like you have fellowship? Now, here's what happens. Some people would say, fellowship with God, tell me what it is. And one person, and I'm going to say all these people that I'm going to say are probably right. It's just not the whole story. Fellowship with God, it's talking to God. You know, you can just talk to God and he talks to you. Now, they're totally right. It's just not, that isn't full enough to describe fellowship. Have you ever been to the DMV? Did you ever talk to the person behind the counter? Did they talk to you? Was that fellowship? No, it was just a business transaction. So please understand, we're talking to God, but you know, just talking to God and having God talk back to you, what that puts people in the position when you say that to them is they have to feel like every time they pray or they try to have fellowship with God, they have to hear something. That's dangerous. I don't hear from him every, I don't hear new things or some word from him every time. I feel like I hear from God plenty, and I feel like I need to hear from him even more. But I don't have this burden on me to when I pray or interact or experience fellowship, it isn't necessarily God talking to me. Another picture. Did you ever go, some of you are hikers. Let's say you're a hiker like many here are. You do some other event, you like bowling, you know, whatever. So you go hiking and you go with a friend or a family member or mate even, and it's like you're not talking to each other, but you're experiencing the same journey. And you get to this bluff where you see this natural phenomena of the fog moving and the mountain and the light shining, and it's just like really phenomenal, and you experience it together, and you look at each other and just go, wow. And you're connected by what you experience together. You're having, in a sense, in a lesser realm than in the spirit with God, but maybe connected spiritually, you're having fellowship over that. It's not, I said this, they said that, I said this, they said that. It's just being together. It's, you're not separated from the person. See, when I sit with God, sometimes the best thing I can do is not talk. You're saying, there's plenty of times for that for you, Rick. The best thing I can do is not talk. And I pray in a prayer language too. But even then, sometimes what I just need to do is take a deep breath and just go, you're here. You're with me. Just realize that he's with me. Are you a Christian? Then if you are, do you realize that God is with you and that he's inside of you? Okay. When you realize that, when you believe that, when you actually believe that, you're in the middle of fellowship with God. That's fellowship. That's oneness, communion with him. It isn't like this practice of things you have to do and get from him or things you have to make sure you give to him. There's layers of all that in life. Fellowship with God. If somebody asked me now, I said, what does it mean to have fellowship with God? I said, it means knowing that you're not separated from him. And when I sinned and wrote my email to my friend, that little silly thing, I wasn't completely separated from God, but it was pushing me away from him, and he was letting me know it. And it wasn't pushing me into hell and pushing me into rejection of Christ. It was pushing me into loss of the fellowship, the sweetness of saying, I'm not separated. I'm not separated from God. Do you realize how great it is to not be separated from God? Some of you feel separated from him a lot, and you're trying to get where you don't feel separated from him. When I say stuff like that, it's because I've talked to hundreds and thousands of people for 40 years who tell me that. I'm not trying to psychoanalyze people. I'm telling you what people tell me constantly for many years. You feel separated from him. And so what you try to do is fix it, or it frustrates you and you run from it. But what you get to do is take a deep breath. Obviously, if there's something specific that he's revealing that needs to be repented of, that's for your benefit. He has washed your sins, but now you get to cleanse your heart, your mind. But what you get to do is have restored fellowship, not separated, communion. He accepts me on the basis of his shed blood. And if I had to feel that every time to know I have fellowship, I'd be a basket case. If you have to feel these things every minute to know you're okay with God, my heart aches for you. You'll never be able to feel it every minute. Do we need to feel it sometimes? I'm sure we do. But I don't spend a lot of time trying to feel it because that's frustrating and takes me on the wrong track. I spend a lot of time choosing to believe it in spite of everything around me, deciding to believe it and just letting God touch me. And of course, the fruit of that sometimes is I really feel it. But I always know where to go. I always know to go to faith to believe his word and his promise, because that's where fellowship is. So you know, we got all these different layers to it. You work out your own layers. How would you explain it to somebody? It's okay. You don't have to do it like me. My question to you is, Do you have fellowship with God? Do you have fellowship with God? Not, are you just doing everything he told you to do? Because Bill already told us we never do everything, and he's right, for not just him. But is your heart, you know, it's really interesting, the heart to go and follow him, the heart to seek him. The basis of communion, our broken relationship has been made whole by his broken body. Our separation has been united by his separation from the Father. My God, why have you forsaken me? You're not separated from him if you're trusting that Jesus was separated from him by bearing your sin. You're not separated from him. And, you know, it's really my alienation and my rejection was dealt with on the cross. In Numbers 21, I'm not just making this up. We don't have to climb a tree to see Jesus. We need to just look to the tree on which he died. And in Numbers 21, that's when Moses, the people who were rebellion, were bitten by serpents, and Moses was told by God to make a brass snake and put it on a serpent snake on a pole and hold it up. And it says, the words are exact here, Moses forged a brass serpent, when the people were bitten and dying for the sin, Moses made a bronze serpent and put it on a pole. And if a serpent bit any one of them, when he looked upon the bronze serpent, he lived. They just went, now how does that change your life? Because it's obvious, they weren't just looking at it physically. You have to look at this and believe that this is the answer. You need to look at this and believe that this is the answer. Do you know everything in those people would say, this is not the answer. It's a brass snake on a stick, okay? I need a real answer. I'm dying here. You don't think anybody did that? They probably died. They had to look up and say, yeah, I believe. It's not more complicated than that. I can't make it more simple. I can't fix your inner workings of your mind and soul. I have plenty of trouble with my own. But I do know that faith is trusting God. That who he says he is, he is. What he says he does, he does. Who he says you are, you are. It's not being high-minded. It's not being filled with yourself. It's believing God. And I don't know how to do better than that. I don't know a trick to do better than that. I don't know a psychology class to help me do better than that. I may unpack some things. God unpacked some things in Gail's life. He's unpacked some things in my life. He's unpacked some things in your life. Sometimes the Lord has to show you why you're the way you are, and I won't go into that right now. Sometimes you have to look at that so you can say, okay, that's how I function. That's why I function that way. But by the grace of God, it's time for a new function. And keep going to the cross. So, restored oneness, wholeness. Musicians, please come up. Instead of brokenness, relationship with God. So we have celebration. And in Revelation 22, let me read you this verse as these guys come up. We're going to pass communion. Oh, Bill, were you going to be up here so you got somebody to take cover? Okay. We're going to pass the communion and hold it and wait. And I'm going to get out of your way. The Spirit and the bride say, come. Let him who hears say, come. And let him who thirsts come. And whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely. Go ahead. I'll revisit this verse in a minute.